Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, a full hour on the Army Reserve. Our guest for this is Chief Warrant Officer Phyllis Wilson. She's the Commanded Chief Warrant Officer for the Army Reserve Command. Later in the program, we'll get a big picture update on the Army Reserve's plans for fiscal 2015, including progress on bridging the gap between military professional certification programs and their counterparts in the civilian sector, and the Reserve's plans to deal with a persistent recruiting challenge. We start, though, with an update on the Reserve's Active Component to Reserve Component Program, or AC to RC, an effort that first started getting off the ground about a year ago and is now up and running at several Army bases here in the U.S. Chief Wilson spoke with us at the Army Reserve's headquarters at Fort Belvoir, Virginia.
The pilot program for AC to RC began at Fort Hood, Texas, and we've had some really great results with that. As a result, now we have five other installations, Fort Bragg being the first one that was rolled out afterwards, to have our reserve component career counselors talk to active duty soldiers as they're considering whether they're going to remain on active duty or if they're going to move back to the civilian sector. And if they do that, then what are their opportunities within the reserve component? And when we say that, we mean both Army National Guard and U.S. Army Reserve.
And how do you get those active component soldiers in the door to talk to you in the first place?
Well, they're pretty much obligated to do that, so that sort of helps. For the longest time, they could only come and talk to reserve component counselors when they were getting pretty close to leaving active duty. The change has been made now because of the downsizing of active components so significant, about 100,000 soldiers will be leaving active duty in the next couple of years. Is they're now being given one full year, 365 days, before they leave active duty to come and talk with us and sort of weigh their options and make some plans. Because one of the things that's been changed as well is, let's say they have an MOS, a skill set, a job in the Army that no longer, it doesn't morph well into the Army Reserve. We do a lot of things like medical, engineering, but we don't have a lot of room for infantry soldiers. And again, infantry soldiering doesn't play well over into the civilian sector many times. So we have the opportunity to actually send them to school while they're still on active duty to learn a trade that will map nicely into the Army Reserve. And so we need more time, and that 365 gives us that opportunity.
Does that 1 year give you what you need generally to take somebody who's been in a brigade combat team and train them to be a lab tech or whatever?
It does. It absolutely does. And even if it doesn't give, if we can't find the right school, because some of these classes are only offered a couple of times a year and they've missed a window or an opportunity, we can still bring them in as that brigade combat team member, as long as we know they've got the aptitude to morph over into a lab tech, as an example, on what we call will train. We will train them. So we bring them in, and shortly after they're in the Army Reserve, we'll get that next class date and send them to school for that. And also, we then help them on their private, their civilian job skills as they become a lab tech. If they want to work as a lab tech on the civilian side, we have links with many companies to help them get a job doing exactly that, which only pays off for the Army Reserve as well, because they've increased their skill set doing the job full-time as a civilian.
Right. But and just to be clear, that training basically starts while they are part of the active Army, and I guess the objective then is to have them ready to hit the ground running as soon as they transition into the reserves.
That's absolutely the case.
So let's go back to the pilot program that you mentioned at Fort Hood. Can you give us maybe some of the takeaways from that experiment, what you learned and what you carried forward into the other installations?
Right. The reserve component career counselors, they have gone out now to more of the units there at Fort Hood. Initially, they were sort of waiting in the offices for everybody that had to come through. They know they're going to be getting out before too long, so they came in and sort of talked to those counselors. But the counselors now have been much more proactive and gone out and are seeking and explaining the opportunities. And more of the soldiers now, instead of just coming in to get their out-processing checklist stamped, please, and they move on, thinking they're not going to continue to serve once they leave active duty, they now understand all of the value and benefits of that. And I think we've done a better job now at the other installations to be more proactive from the beginning.
And I don't know if you have the numbers in your head, but can you give us some sense of the success rate that you've had with the AC-to-RC program so far? I mean, how much of a pipeline has it given you to ingest new soldiers into the reserve?
Right. So just from Fort Hood, we have around 1,100 enlisted soldiers, everything from specialist E-4s up through master sergeants that have made the transition over to the Army Reserve or in the process. They've contracted with us if they're not completely over yet. And then on the warrant officer side, one of those things that we watch closely as well is we have some enlisted soldiers that are active duty that have done their entire warrant officer application packet, and it has been, they've met all the wickets, they've been selected. So once they become an Army Reserve soldier, they'll be going straight to warrant officer school.
Hmm. And how about officers? Because I know your mid-grade officer ranks is something that you've been needing to fill, too.
Absolutely. The mid-grade warrant officer, mid-grade O's, the captains and majors, yeah. We've gotten about 350 active duty captains and majors that have contracted with us now.
Mm-hmm. Are these the people that you brought in through the AC-to-RC program and those counselors that have gone out to talk to these soldiers? I mean, do you feel like these are people who would have otherwise not come into the reserves? I mean, is this added recruitment on top of what you would have gotten had this program not existed?
Probably 80% of those have been brought in might not have contracted otherwise. It really is a messaging issue. I think that a lot of times the soldiers, I was an active duty soldier, and when I left, I really didn't think about becoming an Army Reserve soldier. There wasn't, well, to be fair, we did not see them as our peers. We didn't consider them the same as active duty soldiers. Why would you become an Army Reserve soldier? Was sometimes things that we would hear. Oh, you're a reservist, would be a question that I still get to this day. And yes, I am an Army Reserve soldier and proud to serve as an Army Reserve soldier. But I think we've got to do a better job. We've served for 13 years of combat side by side, guard, reserve, active duty. And short of a patch, they would never know which unit we came from. And not until we're leaving sometimes do they realize you're going back to an Army Reserve location. I didn't know you were Army Reserve. That's exactly the case that we are trying to put across. And I think because of the years of combat and now with the downsizing of active component, the soldiers really do recognize that it's not the Army Reserve of days gone by.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question there is, how do you maintain that level of, you know, these are our peers, this is not some, you know, foreign, distinct, separate army from the active component. How do you maintain that once you're no longer serving in active combat together on a daily basis anymore?
Right. And in years ago, we had what was called multi-component units, which meant that the soldiers from, let's say, a battalion were all three components of the Army: active duty, Army National Guard, U.S. Army Reserve. And it was a way for us to work on a daily basis with each other. That was done away with, but they're actually looking at reforming those kind of multi-component units again. And I think that will be helpful because some of the skill sets that we bring from the civilian sector actually make us more marketable, I would argue, on the Army side than what sometimes the soldiers do. As I said, when I was active duty as a linguist, I was required to maintain that language, but I was in the motor pool more than I was doing my language maintenance. And so sometimes you find your skill sets atrophy, even though you're on active duty, compared to what you thought your career field was supposed to be. But those basic soldiering skills, I think you would argue active component may have those over us, because one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, that muscle memory is in there, but it isn't the same as having done ruck marches once or twice a week, doing PT 3-4 times a week. We just don't do that.
Right. You mentioned messaging. So let me ask another question about the pilot you went through. Did you make some decisions about what worked and what didn't in terms of messaging? How has that strategy evolved when you talk to active component soldiers and try and entice them to come into the reserves?
Right. And those career counselors that we have down at Fort Hood and now at five other locations, some of the lessons learned, if you will, mm-hmm. of what we're saying to the soldiers to get them to understand. And one of those key things was exactly they have 8 or 10 years of active duty time and they're going to just leave and not continue to serve as a guardsman or an Army Reserve soldier. And sometimes we're just talking about the money. And when you discuss that, as an example, a sergeant, an E5 with 10 years of service is leaving active duty. if they opted to become a reserve component soldier and did their just one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, which isn't always the case. Many times we're asked to do more, as you know, with the Ebola issue in Western Africa. Some of our soldiers are already notified they're going to be going. So you can't be be absolutely certain that that's what you have. But when they do come over, they are given a two-year moratorium, if you will, where they do not have to deploy for at least the first 24 months that they become an Army Reserve soldier.
But can volunteer,
They can absolutely volunteer if they want to, and many do. But if they are given that safety net, so if they want to go back to school or they just want to spend more time with their family for that first 2 years, that's guaranteed. But a sergeant with 10 years of service, if they do that just minimal one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, they will earn approximately $7,000 a year as additional money on top of a civilian job. A warrant officer, a W-2 with 10 years time in, if they opted to stay with the Army Reserve, would earn about $10,000 per year as their additional income. And of course, each of those will increase based on promotion and time in service until they hit the 20-year mark, and then they can just, they do have to wait until they're age 60 to draw retirement pay, but it still is a significant amount of money that they would draw as a pension, not to mention those that have gotten out now and realize how much it is for medical and dental premiums. TRICARE Reserve Select and the dental program that we have is significantly cheaper as far as premiums go than what they have to pay typically on the civilian sector. So those are things that we talk to some of these folks as they're looking to leave.
And as we were talking about off the air, a lot of people probably don't think that through entirely before they completely get out of the active component, which brings up another question. If you have gotten out, is there a way to come back in to the reserves and still have your retirement accrue to that 20 years and have your active service count?
Right. And there absolutely is. If soldiers have left active component from any service, whether it be the Marines, the Air Force, or the Army, okay, don't let me leave out the Navy and the Coast Guard. If they've left any of those services, if they opt to, they have a break in service, if you will, we have what's still called prior service. They can come back in. They may have to go all the way through Army basic training. There was just an article recently about an individual that's 55 years old and graduated Army basic training.
Wow.
So it can be done. It's one of those things. I'm almost that age. I don't think Army basic training would be a lot of fun, but I would do it. It is a great opportunity for them to come back in. We still have a lot of incentive bonuses. We're trying our manning. We need soldiers desperately, but not so desperately that we'll take anybody. They have to meet all of the requirements to qualify to become an Army Reserve soldier. But up to $20,000 bonuses to come into the Army Reserve based on their MOS, their skill set, as well as we are offering $30,000 in student loan repayment. So there's a significant amount of money out there to help them offset some issues as they leave active duty, or if they're already out and they want to come in, if they'll affiliate with an Army Reserve unit, $20,000.
That's Phyllis Wilson, the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the U.S. Army Reserve. We'll come back and talk more about the Reserve's efforts to convince departing our active duty soldiers to stay in the fold via reserve duty after a quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Servu. We're talking this week with Phyllis Wilson, the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the U.S. Army Reserve, about the Reserve's plans for 2015, including more refinements to its new active component to reserve component recruiting program. Before the break, Wilson described how the Reserve is trying to tune its messaging strategy to convince more soldiers who are leaving active service as part of the Army drawdown to join the Reserve.
One last thing on messaging, and you kind of alluded to this. It seems to me you've got to be really careful about making the promise one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, because there is this desire to keep this force active and engaged and deployed around the world if they want to, and not have it go back to being a garrisoned force.
Right.
So how do you actually communicate that in the real world? I mean, there's got to be a caveat, right? I mean, something may happen. We may get back into an engagement. You may be assigned to one of these regionally aligned forces, right?
Absolutely. And we have a readiness model so that every Army Reserve unit, every fifth year, is expected to do something meaningful, whether that is a major exercise, training exercise, where they're validated that they are qualified and competent in all of their soldier skills as a unit, not as an individual. Or ideally, things, whether it's here in the United States or overseas, helping to build schools or water purification plants. We go to a number of the Native American Indian reservations and do medical and dental programs. So we bring people up and they hone their skills that they're in the military for, whether it's here in the States or overseas. So every fifth year, that's pretty much a given. You're going to do one of those opportunities. But along the way, there's other training and events, and based on how qualified and competent you are and how short we are in that MOS, that skill set, you may not be in a unit that's scheduled to deploy, but we need you, and we'll reach in and say, tag, you're it. And I know it's only your second or third year since you last did a rotation, but you're going to go again. And, right. and that's part of the issue with, you know, making sure everybody is really well qualified and ready to go. So that the capability to reach in to any unit, it is the luck of the draw. Some people have been arguably used and abused over time by the number of deployments they've had, and others may have never deployed. Some that want to deploy have not been able to for a myriad of reasons. We just didn't need that skill set at this point in time.
As the active Army draws down, can you give me some sense of how much capacity is in the reserve as they go from 520, I think it is, down to 490? Can you, in a perfect world, could you theoretically absorb all those people, or what are your limits?
No, we couldn't absorb all of that. We could. What we're looking for, obviously, is those that we know we can either already have the skill set we require, or that we can train to meet the needs of the Army Reserve. There are a number of soldiers that, to be honest, in any corporation, in any military, there are some folks that probably aren't meeting all of the requirements that we have. A small number, but that happens in every group of people.
Sure.
So we're not necessarily looking to take some individuals, but there are a great number of really great qualified soldiers that, through no fault of their own, just by sheer math, the budget is going to cause some of those soldiers to be forced to come out of active component. So that's where the reserve components are looking to say, we have capacity. We're not as filled up as active duty is. And it's hard for a soldier that came in thinking they might be able to do 20 years of active duty time, and at the 6-8 year mark is being told, nope, sorry. Now they hadn't made all of the good career plans. They don't necessarily have the degree that they need to succeed on the civilian sector. But we can help them with all of that, because they'll continue to receive the educational benefits, everything else that they would had they maintained active duty.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more broadly about recruiting. I think in FY14, the Army Reserve was actually the only DoD component to miss its accession targets. What's behind that? Why are you not getting to where you want to be? And what are you doing to improve?
Well, that's one of those, I wish we had all the answers on that.
Sure.
We don't, because then we would be able to do, a better job on the course correction. One of the reasons I would argue, of course, we have the National Guard, Army National Guard, and we have the Army Reserve. Now, with the National Guards, many of the people that join are young, and they're looking for college education. And in every state, there is a help by being a guardsman with the tuition, which we don't have in the Army Reserve, and that sort of does hinder us at times when we're looking at that same cohort of qualified people, as well as you know, only about 3 out of 10 young people even meet the basic criteria to join any service. So it wickers it down further and further. And sometimes I think, you know, just being an Army Reserve soldier, the Guard does a better job of marketing than we have. And so how do we fix that? We have to be out and about more and really share that what we have are the combat service and service support. And by that I mean the military intelligence, the civil affairs, the engineers, the doctors, the lawyers, the nurses. We have a preponderance of those in the Army Reserve, which the Guard does not have. So if somebody's looking to serve in one of those career fields, the Army Reserve probably is the better answer for them.
Hmm. So let's stick with that for a second, that the Guard issue that you just mentioned. To what extent do you see the Reserve as in competition with the Guard? In what ways do you collaborate in the overall effort to make sure that the big army maintains this pool of talent that's in the active right now?
I would say that, you know, we are in competition because we're struggling to find those same young individuals, typically young individuals that meet the criteria to join the Army, any component. And then some of the issues that they have, if you join, let's say we're in Virginia and you join the Virginia Guard, you are never going to leave the state of Virginia to serve in the National Guard. Whereas if you join in the state of Virginia as an Army Reserve soldier, as you continue to be promoted and progress through your career in the Army Reserve, it's very likely that the next assignment may say, we have a place for you in Georgia, but I live and work as a civilian in Virginia. Roger, got that. That still means one weekend a month, your duty assignment is going to be down in Georgia. Now, we do facilitate with the cost of the travel to get down and back, but that doesn't mean it still takes a lot of time to get down there. And the higher rank you get, it may be California that we're asking you to go to in order to fulfill the mission. And so those are some of the issues that I think we struggle with that the National Guard doesn't. But I am linked at the hip with the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the National Guard, and we are sharing our pool of talent, both the enlisted, the warrants, and the commissioned officers, just to make sure that if there is a place where there's a warrant officer or enlisted soldier that has capped out on promotion in the National Guard, they can come over to the Army Reserve. We'll help them. And likewise, I've seen a number of our soldiers go to the Guard in order to continue to grow their career. Otherwise, they're stagnating, and we really don't want to keep a sergeant forever. They want to become a staff sergeant, a sergeant first class, but they have to move into those positions to be promoted.
Mm. So to choose the example that you just used of a soldier who lives in North Carolina but is assigned to a unit in Georgia, once you join the Guard, do you have at least a theoretical amount of geographic stability? I mean, does the Guard often order people to PCS across the country against their wishes, or can you basically live where you want to even if you have a long commute?
Right. Well, and that's the thing. With the Guard, there's really 54 National Guards. Each state and territory has their own Guard. And each of those are independent of the other. So West Virginia Guard has nothing to do, other than their guardsmen, with the Virginia Guard. So the tag, the adjutant general for the state of Virginia, would have to speak with their counterpart with West Virginia if they needed any help with a natural disaster or whatever. So those are if you're a Virginia National Guardsman, you will always serve in Virginia, short of being mobilized and deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, places like that. So that does save them on the idea. They may have to go to a different part of the state to do their drill as they continue to progress. So Texas would be hard, obviously. You could be a Texas Guardsman and have to go from Fort Bliss, El Paso, to Houston, as an example, as you continue to progress. So it still would be a long commute. But most states, obviously, like Virginia, Maryland, even Washington, D.C. has a National Guard.
But again, in the reserves, would the reserves typically require a soldier, if they needed someone at a different unit in a different location from where they were living, would they typically require that person to move? Or if they wanted to, could they continue to live where they were and just take that long commute one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year?
Right. And many soldiers do stay put, but one weekend a month, they travel quite a distance, and that's not an anomaly. I would probably argue 20% of our soldiers travel out of state to do their Army Reserve service.
Mm. Chief Warrant Officer Phyllis Wilson is the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the U.S. Army Reserve Command. We'll come back and talk more about some of the Army Reserve's broader recruiting challenges after another short break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Our show this week is an update on what's happening with the Army Reserve. Our guest is Phyllis Wilson, the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the U.S. Army Reserve, talking with us about the Reserve's efforts to solve its recruiting shortfalls, both from soldiers who are leaving active service and with brand new recruits.
One more thing back on recruiting. The last time that we talked to you folks in depth, there was kind of a bathtub of both mid-grade enlisted and mid-grade officers. A lot of people, a lot of holes in sort of the E4 to E7 range and in captains and majors. How much success have you had over the past year or two in filling that up? Is it still a struggle?
Well, we're doing better on promoting our E4s to E5s, which is typically the first rank to be a non-commissioned officer as an E5 sergeant. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a better job of making sure those soldiers are being looked at, reviewed properly, and progressed at the right time frame. We had some issues in the past with making sure that they, what we call, were being boarded on time. So that, I think, we've cleaned that up, and we're seeing a significantly more sergeants now than what we had even a year ago. And that will help break that bottleneck, that logjam that we had far too many at the lower rank. Same thing with the officers and even the warrants. We were really short on Chief Warrant Officer 3, which is the mid-grade, because we go W1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So 3s were our mid-grades, and significantly short, less than 50% filled in that one rank. And now we're up around 60%. So it's not great, but we're moving in the right direction, and we're seeing the same thing happen now with the captains and majors. And unfortunately, on the active component side, there were about 1,100 active duty captains that, because of the drawdown, were released. And same thing, there were 600-ish majors. And many general officers from the Army Reserve picked up phones and called those officers and said, please consider following on with joining the Army Reserve. And my understanding is there's been several hundred that have said, yes, I want to contract and move into the Army Reserve. Mm-hmm. And these are folks that have leadership experience in Afghanistan or Iraq. This is a skill set we can't afford to just let them walk away.
You can't replicate that.
No, yeah. You cannot replicate it. It's something that, those battle-hardened guys, same thing with our NCOs, the soldiers from active component, we want to make sure we keep them in a formation. And because of the cost of a soldier on active duty, obviously, with the drawdown, sequestration, and so forth, that budget is meaning that we've got to cut somewhere. And if 20% of the Army is the Army Reserve, but we're only costing about 6% of the total budget, it is a cost saving. As I said, it's only $10,000 for a W-2 to serve for a year as an Army Reserve soldier. But it would cost probably over $100,000 if they were on active duty.
Mm-hmm. So we know about the drawdown that's happening in the active Army. You guys, last I recall, were at, your end strength was at 205. Is there any expectation that that will come down in proportion with the active Army too, or you expect some stability?
It will come down if sequestration stays, right. And we're expecting 195,000. So that was a 10,000 reduction from where we had been. So how we get there and maintain that number is one of those challenges that we do have, but it's not in concert with as much of a drawdown as active duty. The Guard and Reserve are coming down some, but not to the degree that active duty is, because again, they're looking for dollar savings. If we didn't have the requirement to cut the strength, we would keep more of our soldiers, but there's no way, short of asking soldiers to leave active duty, to meet the budgetary requirements that we've been laid upon.
And sorry, just to clarify that 205 to 195 reduction, does that assume full sequestration, or is that already programmed in and then sequestration would take you further down?
Sequestration will take us down probably to 185,000.
Okay.
And so how we get there, and we've already started because we have to do the planning, is looking at, what units, what kind of formations, what are we willing to give up with the least risk to the nation? Because, we have to, the Ebola issue, the things that are happening in Eastern Europe, everything, we're sending a lot of soldiers over there because of the destabilization with the Ukraine and some of the issues there. Every time a unit goes over there that's active duty, they need that support that the Army Reserve has to provide to them. So we always have to be ready. But if we have to go down, what units do we cut? We're not sure, but we're doing a rack and stack and trying to determine what's the least amount of risk. And I don't want to have to see what happens. But if sequestration stays, we will have to make some very hard decisions.
How much of that decision-making process is made in concert with the overall Army, or are those decisions that are basically made within the Army Reserve in terms of what you can afford, the areas in which you can afford to take the most risk in terms of those enabling capabilities?
Well, ultimately, the Chief of the Army Reserve, Lieutenant General Talley, he is basically the one that looks at and makes those decisions. But once he's come up with what he believes right looks like, he certainly talks with General Odierno, the Chief of Staff of the Army, and the Secretary of the Army, Secretary McHugh, to make sure that they are in agreement with what he thinks right looks like. Now, from the Army Reserve perspective, we're fortunate in that General Talley has been both a professor for civil engineering, but he's also been a chief executive officer for his own civil engineering firm. So he understands business practices perhaps better than many other officers in the military, because he's done it hands-on and run a successful organization. So when he looks at this, he does sometimes say, please just tell us how much money we need to give back to Big Army or to the government, and let us make those decisions. But it's one Army, one fight. So while we're one component of the Army, we look at it internally and then give what we recommend the courses of action are, and ultimately the Army makes those decisions and we move out and carry that forward.
Got it. Sorry for jumping around a little bit. I wanted to ask one more question on the mid-grade bathtub issue we were talking about. You mentioned people in the enlisted ranks not getting boards on time as one barrier between that sort of E4 to E5. Was it a similar issue when it comes to officers and warrants, or were there other factors that were barriers to continued service there?
Typically, for the mid-grade officers, to include the warrants, they have 20 years of service when they're getting to about those ranks. And so some of them have said, you know what, I've enjoyed the game. It's been great. I loved every bit of it. But now I'm going to focus more on community service, family, and my civilian career. And so they'll say, okay, I'm parking this. And I know when I turn 60, I'll start drawing a retirement check from the military as well. But it's, you know, they're 45-ish years of age, typically, about that point. And they say, I've had enough of this. I enjoyed it. Now, others do stay on longer than that. But I think by reaching into the active component and asking these folks to come on over, that's helping to fill up, as you said, our bathtub, so that we're actually looking at doing things better, smarter, and also how we do our board or our selection process to the next rank in the officer side of the house. We have the latitude to say we can select folks a little with less time in the grade that they're currently in. So if they're a captain and we need more majors, instead of saying we're waiting until you have 5 or 6 years time in grade as a captain, we can push it back a little bit and say 4.5 years. So it gives us more numbers to select from, and then you'll see more people that get promoted that year. Problem with that is in the future, then they have more people when they're competing for lieutenant colonel that are now in their peer group that they're all vying for that promotion as well. So you have to be cautious how we titrate this. We try to do it over a 5 to 6 year game plan instead of fix it all right now and then pay the price 5 or 6 years down the road again. It's not fair to the soldiers to do it that way.
Right. Chief Warrant Officer Phyllis Wilson is the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the U.S. Army Reserve Command. She'll join us for one more segment when we come back. This is On DoD on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. One more segment with Chief Warrant Officer Phyllis Wilson, the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the U.S. Army Reserve Command. We're talking about the Reserve's overall plans for 2015, including how it's trying to meet its recruiting shortfalls.
In our last few minutes, let's talk a bit about professional certifications. You were telling me off the air that the Army Reserve has been involved for a long time in the whole idea that we need to have certifications that translate from the military world into the civilian world, but there's been an increased focus, I guess, in the past couple of years. Is that a fair way to put it? Talk a bit about what you've been doing and how you've stepped up the game there.
Right, I think so. And as I said, I've been in the Army over 30 years. And as a registered nurse on the civilian side, certainly there's certifications and renewal of continuing education units that have to be done. We offer the same thing for any of the medical professionals in the military, whichever service and whichever component. But let's talk specifically about the Army Reserve, because 87% of the Army Reserve only do, let's say, they're part-time, less than full-time employees for the Army Reserve, but they're typically full-time employees for a civilian company. So if they're a mechanic for the Army Reserve, many times they're a mechanic on the civilian side. So that ASE certification for a mechanic can mean extra pay, and there's a myriad. There's over 15 or 20 ASE certification exams that these soldiers can take. And many companies out on the civilian side pay, it doesn't sound like a lot, but 25 cents per hour more for every one of those certifications. So if you have 10 extra certifications, it's $2.50 per hour. And so those can translate to a bit more, as well as they can move up into management levels over time. So we're looking at that. We have what's been called, it goes under the credential for COOL, COOL, which is Credentialing Online, Credentialing Opportunities Online, COOL. And as a result of that, you can go into, as long as you have your military access card, you can go into the system and for free take any of these training opportunities. Some that have to pay, you have to pay, some exams may cost up to $1,000. We will cover that cost. Many times it's reimbursable, so you have to pay it up front. Once you pass, you bring to the military your passing notification, and we'll refund you the money that you spent on that exam. And that means it translates into significantly higher civilian pay, but it also then means to us that we know we have a higher skill set when we're reaching into somebody that we're saying, we need you to work on the engine for a tank. If we know that they understand troubleshooting more so because of some of the certifications they have, it gives us a little bit more of a safety feeling about that, instead of they're just doing things based on what they were taught in one school.
And those training opportunities that are available through that COOL portal, I assume those are, like you mentioned, the ASE certifications. These are nationwide accrediting bodies for the private sector primarily.
Absolutely. IT. Great number of the information technology. Anybody that works with computers, they can go in there. Even if it's not one of your MOSs, the skill set you have in the military, you can take those exams, and obviously that will layer over into doing well on the civilian sector if that's a field you want to get involved in. So there's a great number of them, hundreds that are out there that are available for our soldiers at no cost.
How much of what you've done to make military certifications and civilian certifications more compatible has been just adopting civilian standards instead of having military unique qualifications? Has there been at least some of that?
There absolutely has. And it's part of many of the military schools, the Army schools that we offer, actually sometimes on Saturday mornings, you can come in and for free take those civilian certification exams. They're provided there for free. You come in and you test on a Saturday morning, obviously, but it is then something that you can carry over. It also counts for promotion points for our enlisted soldiers. There's a number of things that are value added for the soldier. But if we go into the warrant officer specific lane, we're the subject matter experts. We're supposed to be those technically proficient souls. And so to make sure that we maintain our certifications and continue to layer upon layer everything that's out there and not somewhat age out, because that's a worry that I have with the warrant officer community, simply because if we are the project managers, program managers, and we synthesize many of the overarching programs within the Army, let's say petroleum handling, it sounds simple enough, but if you have a major exercise of 5,000 soldiers out at a major fort, and you've got to run water to all of the disparate locations and fuel to all of them, there's a warrant officer that does all of the ordering, and they figure that, okay, there's 72 soldiers at this location. How much water are they going to go through on a daily basis? How frequently do we have to get a truck out there with water? And how many generators are being run? What's the burn rate? And how many gallons of fuel do we have to get out to that location? And you have a number of those. So there's a, if you're going to be the guy or gal that plans and programs all of that for just one major 22-day exercise, there's a lot of math and planning that goes into that and understanding all of the systems and foundations that go with it. So the certifications that we made sure our soldiers have parlay into, okay, great, you just helped us for 3+ weeks. Now you're going to go back to your civilian job, and who do they work for? A logistics firm that manages everything. Let's say like Amazon right now, it's getting to be the holiday season. Can you imagine the logistics of those Cyber Monday orders that are going out all over the place? And that's similar to what we say many of our warrant officers do. Get everything out there at the right time, because soldiers know they want their chow on time, and certainly the pay and things like that. And don't be late on any of that stuff. It really does frustrate, certainly not just the soldier, but the families. Those are things they're counting on.
Last thing before we run out of time, you've talked about the certification issue mostly in the context of people who need to have those certifications both for their reserve jobs and for their civilian jobs. But does the same idea map, and can it be used, for example, by the active Army for soldiers who are transitioning into complete civilian service?
It absolutely does. It's available to all of the soldiers. Many of them, their leadership does try to encourage them, or they'll offer training classes, sort of like prep for the exam. During regular military time, let's say on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, with the idea that on Friday, active duty unit will go and take their tests. And that's, again, provided for free. Many of the national accrediting bodies have done great things for the military writ large to say, we're not going to charge you. We allow these soldiers to get the certification at no cost. And many times they'll even offer the training course at no cost for us. And then lastly is the training with industry, where people like big corporations like Caterpillar, GE Healthcare, other organizations that we work with very closely in the Army Reserve, we have some of our soldiers that go there and train for 90 days, 6 months at a time to really build that skill set with what they need to do when they come back and serve with the Army Reserve.
All right. Well, Chief Wilson, it's been a really great overview of the Army Reserve. Thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
That is Chief Warrant Officer Phyllis Wilson, the Command Chief Warrant Officer of the U.S. Army Reserve Command, talking with us about the Reserve's plans for 2015, including how it's trying to meet its recruiting shortfalls, and the now up-and-running Active Component to Reserve Component program, the Reserve's effort to entice as many departing soldiers from the Active Component of the Army into the Reserves as it can. If you missed any of our interview, we will post the entire program, as always, at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. That's going to do it for this week's program. Thanks, as always, for listening. Hope you'll tune in again next week. I'm Jared Serbil. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.